Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Jurnov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is basically whenever you want to download it and listen to it. Today we have a great show. We have Ron Hedges on, back on our show again for a third time to now talk about what I'll refer to, Ron, as your annual year-in-review top 10 e-discovery cases list.
Okay, fair enough.
We did one last year, and we're going to look at e-discovery opinions rendered in 2009, and anyone who tracks either electronic discovery or ESI Bytes knows who Ron Hedges is. He's served as a United States magistrate judge in the District of New Jersey from 1986 to 2007, and he's been at the forefront of e-discovery for years. He's a member of the Sedona Conference Advisory Board and participates in Sedona working groups on e-discovery and records, international e-discovery and confidentiality and public access. He's also a member of the advisory boards of the Advanced E-Discovery and Corporate Counsel Institutes of Georgetown University Law Center, where he teaches e-discovery and evidence as an adjunct faculty member. And among many other publications, he's the author of Discovery of Electronically Stored Information, Surveying the Legal Landscape with BNA in 2007, and co-author of Managing Discovery of Electronic Information, a pocket guide for judges for the Federal Judicial Center, also in 2007. And now he consults on e-discovery and records management issues and can be reached at r_hedges@live.com. Ron, thanks for joining us again. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, and thank you for letting me participate.
Great. And before we start looking backwards at the top 10 list, and rather than getting your how you got started in e-discovery, since you've done that two times already, why don't we just generally talk about what you see looking forward in 2010 for trends within e-discovery.
Well, I expect a couple things that are going to be happening. First, I expect you're going to see a renewed emphasis on proportionality. Up until last few years, proportionality, which is really basic to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and discovery, has been kind of a stepchild. And as electronic discovery has picked up, we've started to see a lot more references and uses to Rule 26b2c, which is the proportionality rule. The Sedona Conference is looking into the question of proportionality. We're seeing more decisions on proportionality. So I think that's going to move us a lot in a direction of cost control or delay control. Second, I see a move afoot, certainly at least by some organizations, to see some amendments to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. There is going to be a large conference at Duke in May of this year by the Civil Rules Advisory Committee where there's generally going to be a discussion of the scope of the rules. I really don't see anything happening with that, if for no other reason that it takes a long time in the rulemaking process to make rule changes. But that's something else I think we're probably going to be seeing over the year. The next thing I expect we're also going to be seeing is something coming from TREC. And those of you who are not familiar with TREC, that is established under the National Institute for Standards and Technology. Maura Grossman is now in charge of that now. And TREC, or more like Legal TREC, is going to be looking at automated review mechanisms and the like, which I think everyone is interested in because at least anecdotally, the largest component of e-discovery expense are privilege review costs. So those are some things I expect we're going to be seeing this year, including a renewed emphasis on automated search technologies. And there's my prediction for 2010.
All right, we'll see. We'll see about that in 2011 when we do the show again. So
yes,
I'll
will.
Hold you to that. All right, now let's start with the top 10 list. For the 10th area that you focused or you found a good case on, the interplay between federal and state court has been an area where we've seen lots of discussion about this year. In fact, we did an ESI Bytes podcast on working with state court judges, and everyone in the field recognizes this as an area where lots of movement will undoubtedly occur over the next few years. Tell us about your first case on the top 10 list.
Well, before I even talk about the case, I just want to take a second with you and talk a little bit about developments that might be happening in the course of the year. California passed its Electronic Discovery Act over last summer. We really haven't seen much case law on that. And I'm not aware of any states that are really looking actively at e-discovery statutes now, other than New York. There's a proposal in the New York legislature to amend the CPLR to address electronic discovery. But you're also beginning to see state courts that don't have specific e-discovery rules looking to the federal rules for guidance. It might be done as a matter of comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y. It might be done just on a recognition that the federal courts have been spending a lot of time on these rules now. And the case I picked to talk about this year that addresses that issue is Weekly Homes, which came out of the Texas Supreme Court last August. And there was really a question about production of information in different formats and the like, and how you go about asking for information and getting responses to it. And you'll see that Weekly Homes really imports into the state practice as a matter of common law, not as a matter of rule or statute, Rule 34B's process to ask for information. So I think we're going to be seeing in the course of this year decisions like Weekly that are going to look to the federal rules of civil procedure and federal case law because it's so well established in the area, and add that into state practice in different judicial bodies. Weekly came out, as I said, over the summer. There was another Texas appellate decision from an intermediate court of appeals that came out in November that follows up on Weekly and talks about what parties should be doing and not doing when they're trying to seek inactive or backed up data.
Okay. The ninth case or ninth area you identified was a case which deals with juror misconduct and e-discovery. You want to talk about Russo v. Takata Corp?
I really have this in there as an exemplar of a problem that has always existed and in a sense is getting worse because of social media and the like. There has always been a problem about jurors going out and doing their own independent research. But in the world of electronic information and the like, you have the added problem where not only jurors can sit home at night in front of a computer or on an intelligent phone or whatever, a smartphone, and look things up. Jurors can be sitting in a jury room and basically doing the same thing and sharing the results of their searches with other jurors. So you could find yourself in a situation where there's been a disclosure of some type of investigation or whatever that a juror has done, which the juror should not be doing, obviously, one way or the other, and then communicating that to other members of the jury, which causes any one of a number of problems and can lead to mistrials. And we've seen these issues develop both in the civil and the criminal side now. Russo was a case where a juror decided to do some internet research and share the results of his research with other jurors, the consequence of which something needs to be done about dealing with all these information. What happened in Russo is that a juror did a Google search about parties after he'd gotten a jury summons, but before the voir dire happened. He's in deliberations, he makes the results of the search known to other jurors, and what happens is a court grants a new trial because of juror contamination or juror misconduct, says that the search results are extraneous information, which a juror cannot bring into a courtroom, and also that a reasonable juror could have been influenced by that information. And at the same time, and this is the new South Dakota Supreme Court, suggests that juror information forms need to be changed to try to remind jurors that they should not be doing that type of research. And by the way, they shouldn't be doing internet research as well. It also talks about and suggests the need for judges, as they're conducting voir dire of possible jurors, to ask if they've done any type of internet work. So it's a fascinating decision. In itself, it's not unique, but it certainly demonstrates a problem that I expect people are going to be following as we go forward.
Yeah, and, you know, as you look, I mean, just using my family as an example. You sit around the table, everyone's got, I got my BlackBerry as an extension of my hand. My daughters have their PDAs out, and it's part of your life. You go right to your phone and look at stuff. I'm sure this is going to be a growing problem.
Well, I suppose the next question and the next thing judges consider doing is telling people they can't bring their smartphones in with them. And then you're asking a juror to be shut off from the world for 8 hours. And in the world today, where people are used to instantaneous access to things, that's a lot to ask. So I don't know how that will play itself out, but it's certainly an interesting question.
Jurors can go with almost a Twinkie defense type of a defense.
Yeah.
I had to. It's attached to my hand.
Well, that's unfortunate, the problem. And, you know, you're also seeing kind of related issues now where some people are trying to blog out of courtrooms during trials and the like, and there are issues coming up with that. So the whole concept of handheld gear, if you will, intelligent phones or whatever you want to call them, or smartphones, is really going to be an issue that courts are going to have to deal with, and generally in the courtroom context, but more likely than that in the juror context.
Okay. The next area, the eighth area on the list, you had a couple of cases that dealt with the issue of search warrants, and if you'd like to comment about these two cases and their importance in the e-discovery field.
Well, comprehensive drug testing has no importance in the civil field. What it does do, though, is set a new standard within the Ninth Circuit for how government agents need to ask for search warrants. It has enormous implications about what type of information needs to go into a search warrant application presented to a judge. For example, there has to be pre-execution of warrant protocols suggested as to how to deal with ESI. It raises the specter that depending on the electronically stored information coming in, the government needs to create taint teams or retain third parties to do searches. It also requires that when the government comes in and is seeking ESI, at least volumes of CSI, the government also has to agree that they won't attempt to raise the plain view doctrine, which comes up often where you're looking at it. You're in a house, for example, and you see in front of you something that's contraband or illegal while you're performing a legal search. That's called plain view. We're starting to see a lot of case law develop in this area now because, not surprisingly, a lot of information is electronic. And unfortunately, we're also seeing a lot of it come up in the area of child pornography because I came from a judge's background years ago, and anyone will tell you that the availability of child pornography on the Internet is just incredible, and it leads to prosecutions and it leads to issues about search warrants and the like. The other case I have here, Rocky Mountain Bank, is really kind of an outlier. You don't see much about it. It's really not electronic discovery per se, but it's a fascinating case, and it's really got two aspects to it. The first aspect is whether or not a party can come in and get a sealing order to basically prohibit public access to any of its filings. And this is just fascinating because, again, we're talking about technology. The bank here, by mistake, sent information about 1,000 of its customers off to an unknown email account. The bank tries to get information back. No one responds at that account. They go to Google, who is the ISP. Google won't help identify the person and the like. So the bank has to go to court. And the first thing it does is seek a sealing order, essentially saying, look, we don't want our customers to know what happened. We're afraid they're going to panic or whatever. And the bank and the court said, no, that doesn't work. The other interesting thing, though, that happens is the court enters a temporary restraining order that requires Google, among other things, to basically shut off the account. So in theory, what's happened here, we have a totally innocent person because he erroneously received information sent by someone else, no longer has access to an email account. And so maybe he had other accounts, maybe he or she or the organization didn't have other accounts, but it's just an interesting approach to what a court might do to erroneous disclosure of information.
Okay.
And then the case settled, by the way, and it's still alive, though, because there is a media organization that wants to come in and unseal an affidavit that Google had to file which was filed under seal, that identified the individual who had the account. So it's just an interesting decision. It's not about electronic discovery.
Okay. Well, these cases, the next set of cases do fall right into e-discovery, and the area of sanctions, which is always a very fact-specific area and draws a lot of attention because no lawyer wants to make the list on one of these cases unless your motion for sanctions wins. And I think we morph four cases here into this top 10 list and we'll count as one area. There were obviously more decisions in the Qualcomm case, which you'll talk about, the poster child for sanction cases right now.
But we don't have a decision coming out, although I understand there's a hearing going on now. What we've had in the last few months are filings by Qualcomm's attorneys, the attorneys who were subject to an order to show cause, as well as by Qualcomm itself as a corporate entity, talking about what was done and what's not done. And for those of you listening to this who aren't familiar with Qualcomm, what happened essentially is that Qualcomm failed to produce a significant amount of email traffic related to a central defense that was asserted by the defendant here. The upshot of all this is that there's default judgment. There's a judgment entered against Qualcomm invalidating the patents. It's sanctioned about $8 million, I believe. And perhaps more interestingly for those listening who are lawyers, the court issues an order to show cause why sanctions shouldn't be imposed on individual lawyers for what turned out to be a discovery fiasco in the case. It goes to a magistrate judge. Leaving everything else aside, the magistrate judge directs sanctions against a certain number of people, goes back to the district court. The district court says, wait a minute, there had to be a waiver of the attorney-client privilege so the lawyers could defend themselves. Goes back to the magistrate judge. And over the course of 2008-2009, there was apparently significant discovery done. We, the community, know something was going on, but towards the end of the year, we started seeing filings that were made by the former attorneys who were subject to order to show cause, as well as Qualcomm. And it's really interesting because there's a young associate who, reading his declaration, has not been able to find work since this debacle happened, basically saying, I saw a problem of some sort, I saw some information, I brought it to the attention of my superiors within the firm, and that's what I was supposed to do. And then you have briefs coming in from other attorneys talking about what they did or didn't do and whether they can be sanctioned. And you have Qualcomm coming in with, I don't know, I guess we could call it kind of a vanilla brief or vanilla papers or whatever, talking about what they did. So, as I mentioned before, the saga continues. They may or may not be in hearings this week. I just don't know. But I believe they are. And at some point, the magistrate judge who has this all again is going to be issuing another ruling as to who should be sanctioned and why. And we're really talking about the former attorneys of Qualcomm who are on the receiving end of the order to show cause. But it's fascinating just because these latest submissions bring to light tensions that developed after the fact, if not before, within a firm representing Qualcomm, and between the firm and its client. So stay tuned for this. There's going to be more on that.
Yeah,
and I don't know if you want to comment on it, Carl.
We did a podcast going through Qualcomm, and I've always thought that once Qualcomm comes out completely and it's, you know, we've vetted a lot of the information, it'll be a great topic lead into essentially project management. Because there's a lot of finger-pointing, and it just appears there was some bad communication going on.
Well, that may be, but I wonder what the project management is. We're really going to be seeing Qualcomm teach people, and I think it may teach more project management within a law firm than anything else.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And then between a law firm and communications with the client as to what the client did or did not do. So there's a lot of interest there. And obviously people are interested in it. Those of us who do e-discovery are interested in it. I've done some ethics programs with Maura Grossman and Gene Thomas where we talked about Qualcomm in the context of attorney ethics in the world of electronic discovery. So it's just a fascinating case. and we'll see what happens to it as it goes forward.
Two other decisions that came down have added some wrinkles or clarity on who on the team should be sanctioned. The Pinstripe v. Manpower case in Northern District of Oklahoma and Swofford v. Esslinger in the Middle District of Florida. You want to talk about these cases?
Well, I don't think Pinstripe brings much clarity to anything, to be honest with you. It's interesting. There is loss of information because a litigation hold wasn't implemented. Emails are, at one point, finally found, so there's no need for an adverse inference instruction or the like. But the problem then becomes, who's responsible for having spent money to recover the email, which is about $30,000? And this judge has a really interesting analysis. The judge is looking at counsel for the party that's in trouble and says, okay, attorneys, you sent a notice to your client a certain period of time ago telling them to implement a litigation hold. You really had no reason to think they didn't implement the litigation hold and comply with your instructions, so you're okay. Then it also looks at local counsel, and the court says, well, you're a local counsel. You really didn't do anything. You didn't have much to do with this one way or the other. We're not going to sanction you either. So at the end of it, what happens is, if there's got to be some depositions done, the defendant who was responsible, who lost the information, has to pay for deposition expenses. And by the way, there's a penalty being assessed on the defendant that's going to be used by the Tulsa Bar Association for a future seminar on litigation holds. So it's interesting the way it treats counsel, because it basically says, you know, counsel, you've told them to do it. It was okay for you to assume you're do it. They did it. You're okay. And it lets local counsel out of off the hook. Really fascinating as to what the judge or what the court is looking at as they're doing all these things. The other decision is Swofford. Swofford's pretty recent out of Florida, and it's just fascinating because we have a problem here where the defendant police department basically didn't keep records of either a wrongful arrest or an excessive use of force arrest of an individual, Mr. Swofford. He, the general counsel, comes into court to testify. And the judge, as you read this opinion, is pretty unhappy with what the police department did in the town. And they wind up sanctioning the general counsel. Now, I could see that if he was an attorney of record, although I don't believe he was. But he really came in as a witness talking about what was happening. And if I'm right that he wasn't an attorney of record, the judge is reaching out to a non-party officer of an organization or whatever, if you call it that, and imposing sanctions on him. So it's really interesting. It's kind of a hybrid, imposing sanctions on an attorney or on an employee who was in charge of things within an organization. Although you wonder if he was the general counsel, he was in charge of preservation efforts. So it's another fascinating decision to see how a court may wind up addressing problems.
Yeah, and it's also the first case I think anyone's been able to point to where in-house counsel is actually being sanctioned. So it's
the only one I have seen where in-house counsel are being sanctioned, per se. Certainly there have been sanctions imposed against corporations and outside counsel. Phoenix 4 from the Southern District of New York is an early decision about that. And it doesn't have to be about electronic discovery for that. But to single out an individual attorney, especially the general counsel, and sanction him, I think people are concerned about this. Now, bear in mind, you know, it's a district court. There are 93 or 94 district courts in the country. There are hundreds of district judges. This has not gone up on appeal. And we don't know if it will ever go up on appeal because most things are never appealed. So we'll have to see how that comes out, whether this is an outlier or is this a trend that judges may start in the future just to try to get things done.
Now let's talk about the large sanction award case here, the Magana versus Hyundai Motors of America.
Magana is fascinating for one reason, because it comes out of a state court. It is not a federal decision. It's not under the federal rules of civil procedure. It's by the Washington Supreme Court from last November. We have a products liability case the trial court imposed a default judgment on the defendant of about $8 million, measured by an earlier jury verdict. And what's fascinating here is the $8 million sanction imposed by the court for discovery misconduct essentially reinstates the jury verdict that had been imposed on the merits by the jury, but vacated. So after there had been a reversal of the jury demand, the case goes back to the trial court. There's discovery about discovery and the like. And then the plaintiff seeks sanctions because the defendant had failed to produce information about related claims from, among other things, a database. And then the trial court found that the defendant, and this is the interesting part, the defendant was a sophisticated multinational corporation experienced in litigation, and it had to maintain a document retrieval system. So that's pretty fascinating right there. After that, then the judge effectively reimposes the jury verdict as a sanction. It goes back up the appellate chain to the Washington Supreme Court. And here the Supreme Court says a corporation must search all its departments, not just its legal department, when a party requests information during discovery. And then the Supreme Court goes on to conclude that the defendant had acted willfully, that the plaintiff had been prejudiced because it couldn't prepare for a new trial absent discovery, and that the award was appropriate because the defendant had behaved atrociously. A fascinating decision, talking about requirements imposed on corporate entities. And by the way, for the audience in UCORL, if you don't know, Judge Shindlin has just issued a new decision in the Southern District of New York in the Pension Committee case, where it begins by basically, quote, Zubelake Revisited, close quote. And it talks about what the organization in issue needed to do. And it's fascinating because I think it sets a very high standard now for organizations.
Yeah, Jonathan Redgrave just emailed this to me a couple days ago to look at, said it's fascinating. And my only complaint is Redgrave never emails me anything unless it's, you know, longer than 70 pages in length. So,
well, let me tell you, this has been making the rounds. I mean, I think the decision was filed on Monday. I got it Monday or Tuesday. Coincidentally, there was a Georgetown planning program telephone call on Tuesday. I circulated to everybody on that. And I'm starting to get emails back from people. Now, whether they got it from me or they got it from someone who forwarded it or another source, I don't know. But it is making the rounds of the e-discovery community.
What?
And it should. And it talks about Zubelake. I think the most fascinating part of it, other than the standard I think it's holding an entity to, is Judge Shindlin's discussion of scienter, or intent, for the imposition of sanctions, for those of you who don't remember Latin. And it's just a long decision, though. It's 85 pages. A good part of it are applying the legal principle she cites to the facts in the case. So we'll see. It's just interesting. I expect there's going to be a lot of play about it as we go forward.
You've got an easy one for next year's list.
Yes, I do. I think I've got... Well, I don't know. We'll see. You know, there's a lot of things going on, and I don't recall if it's in my list. It may not be, but we have the Kwan decision out of California, the Ninth Circuit, that's now the Supreme Court has taken cert on. So that's going to be a very fascinating decision, but maybe we can talk about that another time or later on today.
Yeah, that's at the end of the list. The other other thing I want to mention is when you were talking at the beginning about proportionality, mm-hmm. I did a podcast with Judge Rosenbaum from Minnesota and Jonathan Redgrave on that topic, and one of the questions I asked was about whether companies really were obligated to invest huge sums of money into complex document management systems if they don't see massive litigation all the time. And we had an interesting dialogue on that because some in the industry would make you believe you have to, but it flies in the face of, you know, proportionality and resource allocation.
Well, it's a risk-benefit analysis. Now, at some point, an organization is going to have to say, look, we don't get sued, or we don't get sued about this product, or we don't get sued about this or that. And at some point, when you're looking at the cost to implement some of these systems, they cost a lot of money, number one, to install, and number two, to keep going. And then they need to be monitored and the like. So there are a lot of resources that go into systems. But we're also seeing some decisions where judges are expecting parties to do that. at least at some context, and certainly when it's reasonably anticipated that there's going to be litigation.
They don't always work. That's the other problem, because the devil's in the details of executing on them.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and supervising them and doing everything else. So it's a major issue, I think.
All right. Well, let's go back to the list here. You know, one area which we did two podcasts on last year was the area of litigation holds. And this case was mentioned in both of these podcasts, but it's worth talking about again, the Phillips M. Adams versus Dell. Out of District Court in Utah. Why don't you share your thoughts on this?
Well, number one, let me tell everyone that this is a magistrate judge's decision. As far as I know, having looked at the docket in the last week, there is a motion for reconsideration pending before the magistrate judge, and there may be an appeal before the district judge. And there's a lot going on in this case on matters other than e-discovery, but I think the question you're raising is twofold. Number one, there was a long period of time before the litigation commenced that a hold shouldn't have been implemented. I believe it was 7 years. And then number two, the duty to implement the hold really comes not from any knowledge a specific party has, but because the party has knowledge that there's litigation in the field. And it should have known that it would be online. So the length is interesting. Forget about the length. And then whether or not this party had a reasonable likelihood of litigation, which is what triggers the hold, is also another issue. And then Phillip Adams also is important because it talks about a circumstance where the party here effectively relied on self-collection to have things put together. And the court said, no, you can't do that. That doesn't work. And effectively, it's suggesting an automated system along the line you just talked about, Carl.
Hmm.
So we'll see what happens. You know, there's, as I said, there's either a reconsideration pending or an appeal in both. But it's been 9 months now, so I'm expecting at some point we're going to see some decision out of Utah on this.
Okay. Now we're into the home stretch. Number five, you looked at some of the development in international e-discovery, and we only did one podcast last year on this topic with Jim Daly, but we've got a couple lined up already for this year. So what are your thoughts of In Re Global Power Equipment Corporation?
Well, there are a couple things going on here. First, the European Union, a European Union working group, is trying to address the question of conflicts between European laws generally and the United States with regard to discovery. The Sedona Conference, of which you mentioned I am a member, has a white paper out on cross-border conflicts or issues. And what you see in the Delaware case I cited, it's a bankruptcy decision out of Delaware, talks about what kind of analysis the judge does when he decides whether to direct a party to produce information under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure or use the Hague Convention. And the answer generally is here, look, you know, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure are superior as a mechanism. It's not discretionary to comply with the federal rule, and there are sanctions for it, and the Hague just is not convenient. But I think it illustrates a tension that you're going to have, because one of the arguments the party made here, who is arguing for the Hague Convention to get information, was we're exposed to criminal penalties if this information is turned over or processed under the European Privacy Directive or under an anti-blocking statute. And one of the cases I think we talked about last year, Carl, was a prosecution in France where someone was convicted of effectively processing information to get ready or either get ready for or comply with a U.S. court order or U.S. litigation. So this is a continuing topic. It's certainly issues that go forward one way or the other. Obviously, so much business is international now. So many organizations are international. Data may be kept in different places. There's just a big area that could explode one of these days. And Jim certainly works on it a lot.
Okay, well, number four on the list, not all e-discovery cases are scary. Some offer some good practical advice, and you looked at this area for this case for a sensible approach to ESI production and form, the high-voltage beverage LLC versus Coca-Cola Company. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I enjoy this case, and it comes back actually to proportionality that we talked about at the beginning. Trademark infringement case, the defendant, Coca-Cola, produced almost 2 million documents. The plaintiff demands more information, and the defendant identifies about 17 million gigabytes, or a lot of more information.
or a lot of information.
Basically, I think I have the number wrong, but in any event, it was about 1.5 million more documents that someone had kept for other litigation. And the question was whether Coca-Cola was required to produce information after it had prepared to give over without review and had offered the other side an opportunity to do a keyword search. The court relies on the proportionality rule, 26B2C, says, look, the defendant's already produced responsive documents. Really, you shouldn't be doing anything more, indexing it and the like. But the court said at the end, you know what, defendant, give them another opportunity to search the information at your place of business on your computers. And meanwhile, because it's kind of a novel question, the court doesn't award any costs. I mean, this is really, to me, a common sense approach to discovery, and it takes into proportionality, and I think it comes back to what I said before. As a development this year, I think we're going to see courts being more willing to use the proportionality rule to control what's going on in discovery.
Okay, great.
Nice little decision out of North Carolina.
Okay, and I should add, I'm probably going to post the decision sites on the right on the description of the show on the website. So now into the final three here, and one of the themes that comes out in eDiscovery all the time is privacy rights. We talked about that in a couple of the decisions earlier. When eDiscovery is conducted, there are often privacy issues that need to be factored in. And why don't you tell us about Quan, the Arch Wireless Operating Company. You alluded to it earlier, so we might as well talk about it now.
Well, the question in Quan essentially are the rights of an employee who happened to be a police officer to do IM over his employer's systems. And there's a lot of case law on this developing. There's a case in front of the New Jersey Supreme Court called Stengard that's going to address this. But the overlay here of Quan is that this police officer, because he's involved with a public agency, has Fourth Amendment rights, constitutional rights. And the question is whether, or in the question the Supreme Court took, is there a reasonable expectation of privacy under Fourth Amendment jurisprudence in this situation? So I think Quan's really fascinating. You could probably make an argument that the electronic nature of the information is kind of incidental, but it's not, because it's obviously central to what's going on. And there is a lot of case law developing, both on the civil and the criminal side now, as to what a reasonable expectation of privacy is. I mean, for example, there's a recent criminal decision that just came out that says that a person has a reasonable expectation of privacy in the contents of his smartphone because of all the data that can be stored on it. This guy is arrested. The police do a warrantless search of the phone, find information, try to get more, and the court said, well, wait, this is really a lot of information here. You didn't need to do it. You needed a warrant. But I think Quan gives the Supreme Court an opportunity to weigh in the Fourth Amendment context here. So watch for Quan. Cert was taken, I believe it was taken in December or early January. So I think you're going to see a decision from the Supreme Court on this by the end of the term. It's going to have a lot to do with privacy rights, employer-employee investigative rights more than anything when you're a public employer and the like. I think you're going to look at state law, though, to deal with the normal employer-employee issue. Like if I was working for someone in New Jersey and I used a system, do I have an expectation of privacy in it?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think state courts are going to see a lot of the privacy decisions come down and you know, also smaller matters. And so many people carry these types of devices around. I can see where these issues are going to come up all the time with single hard drives, that any, you know, discovery on a hard drive, privacy right away.
Well, the other thing you're going to see, I think, is a divergence between what the United States Supreme Court says is privacy and what state courts do. Because a lot of privacy rights derive from state constitutions and state law, and states, for example, California, New Jersey, their constitutions are not interpreted to be coextensive with the reach of the U.S. Constitution. So it's interesting. We'll see how this turns out. New Jersey, for example, my home state, has had some decisions within the last 2 years that look at the New Jersey Constitution as giving broader protections than the United States Constitution does.
Okay, now number two on the list, now we're getting to the area I find interesting, the search and retrieval area. We've done at least three or four podcasts in this important area, and granted I'm biased, I work in this space, but you cited USC Sensient Colors, Inc., which deals with the automated privilege review and reasonableness under Rule 502B. What's your takeaway on this case?
Well, let's leave the 502B aspects of it out of it for a degree, because that's another whole hour discussion about what 502B means. So essentially what happens is the United States does an automated review. It makes some mistakes. It turns over things it shouldn't. And they were just in the process of installing this automated technology, basically, when all this broke. And the court there, again, I think takes a really common sense attitude and basically says, you know, you tried. You gave it a good shot. There was no intent on your part to hide anything or not disclose anything. Good intentions. It was a reasonable effort. We're going to protect the documents. Now, they went back and said, you know, only to some degree. And the question is, there was a waiver at some point because it took the government too long to discover things to talk about it. But sentient colors is important to me because it recognizes automated reviews, and it recognizes this whole idea of reasonableness in doing a review, and you don't penalize someone for trying as long as they don't totally screw it up, I think is the teaching of that decision. And it also interprets 502B, which is Federal Rule of Evidence 502B, which is a rule about waiver of work product and attorney-client privilege, and there's a lot of case law that's come out in the last year or so interpreting that. As I said, we could spend hours on.
I did an hour podcast with Judge Grimm and Tom Wallman on this topic, and probably read about 200 pages of material to prepare for it. So we can bypass that whole area right now and go on your number one.
Okay.
Number one on the list, drum roll. This case seems like it had some interesting facts, which sends shivers up the spines of lawyers and clients, inadvertently turning over the smoking gun document, trying to get it back. Wald v. El Centro Finance.
It has nothing to do with electronic discovery, but it's got to do with electronic transmission inadvertently. And it's nothing to do with privilege. Mr. Wald applies for a job with the defendant. He's a gentleman in his older years, which I hate to say is where I'm going these days. He hasn't heard anything for a while. He asks what's going on, and inadvertently, the president or the CEO of the defendant sends an email to him that was intended for someone else, basically suggesting that he's an old guy and he's looking for a job and we don't want him. I think is the characterization that the plaintiff could best take on it. And the whole question is whether or not that email is enough to defeat a motion for summary judgment or a motion to dismiss made by the defendant. And the court says, yeah, that's enough. There's a genuine issue of triable fact here on the defendant's state of mind, if you will. And it's just the perfect example of hitting the wrong key on a computer and sending it to the wrong person. And, you know, we know that happens.
Yep.
We see it all the time. Judge Facciola just wrote an opinion a little while ago in Washington where he said, you know, tongue-in-cheek, lawyers sometimes make mistakes. We know judges never do, but here was a mistake made. And protect something from disclosure. But I think it's a good example of the world of unintended consequences when you communicate electronically. And you're not sure how you're doing it, or you make a mistake. And I'm sure just about everyone listening here at one time has hit a reply all button instead of a reply button or some wrong button that you know you're sorry you did after you did it. And here, in this case, there was a consequence. And the consequence was the plaintiff gets to proceed with the case against the defendant where the email originated. And it actually does sound like a smoking gun. Kind of a smoking gun. You know,
yeah.
There aren't many real smoking guns anywhere. But it's just an interesting little case.
Yep.
Totally meaningless in the real world. But as I said, it's an interesting little thing about inadvertent consequences of doing something.
And you're right, everyone's done it. So, all right. Well, Ron, thanks again for joining us on another show. It's always a pleasure to have you on to share your knowledge with us and our listeners. And looking forward to doing more shows with you later this year. And just to let you know, you've now joined Ralph Losey in pulling ahead of Judge Grimm and Facciola by doing your third show with ESI Bytes. So,
wow.
Like the top 10 list on the AP for football. You know, it's going to change over the course of the year, but you're on top now.
Well, if nothing else, forward in 2011 to do the top 10 of 2010. How's that?
That sounds fine. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes with a Y for a complete list of our shows. You can also remember our show and website phonetically by the phrase Easy Bytes, which is also how I'd like our show to be perceived, not just easy bytes of ESI information, but more importantly, easily digestible. So anyway, however you remember to choose to remember us, just come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Jurnov, wishing you a nice day. Goodbye.
Carl, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.